disappearance. It wasn't just someone's crazed vendetta against Jedi. So far, they hadn't proven that. But at the moment, this was the only lead he had. He had to follow it and trust in the Force to guide him to his wife.
"One problem," he said. "Playing dead with you carrying me leaves me in a position where I can't easily react or fight back. What if he decides to take another shot at me, just to make sure?"
"A reasonable concern," Thrawn conceded. "Have you an alternative suggestion?"
Anakin looked around the cantina. None of the bodies was the right size for him or Thrawn to adopt their clothing. Or was there anything else in sight that could be used as a disguise? On the other hand...
"You said he's afraid one of his friends survived," he said. "Let's play on that."
Reaching out to the Force, he got a grip on one of the dead humans and lifted him off the floor.
"Interesting,"
Thrawn said. If he was startled by the body's sudden movement, it didn't show in his voice.
"This requires a change in the story, though. The Jedi he sought to kill will now be alive."
"I like this one better," Anakin growled.
"I didn't say it was worse. Merely different,"
Thrawn said mildly.
"Can you make him appear to be living?"
"Let's find out."
It turned out to be trickier than Anakin had expected. Life wasn't just limbs moving back and forth, he quickly discovered, but also the more subtle flexing of muscles beneath the skin, plus the interplay of muscle groups with balance and kinesthetics. An hour's worth of practice, and he would have had it down cold. But a few minutes was all he got before Thrawn called a halt.
"That will be sufficient, and we have no more time," the Chiss said. "I suggest you take him out and lay him across the top of your fighter for transport."
Anakin thought about that. Balancing him up there would be tricky, even wedged in between the canopy and R2-D2's dome.
"He'd fit better in the landspeeder,"
he pointed out.
"Would you normally leave your fighter behind while transporting a prisoner?"
Anakin scowled. Under certain circumstances, that wouldn't be completely out of the question. Here and now, though, he had no intention of leaving his Actus unattended.
"You're right," he said. "Okay, I'll take our puppet and head out. Any particular direction you want me to go?"
"I suggest you fly toward the Ambassador's ship,"
Thrawn said.
"If our attackers were alerted by the smugglers, they'll know of that spot, and assume you're traveling there. Meantime, I'll endeavor to identify and follow our quarry."
"Right," Anakin said. "I'll go nice and slow to keep the jamming field over the whole area as long as possible."
"Very good."
Thrawn eased himself out of his chair and turned around. Anakin caught his breath. The chest of the Chiss uniform had turned from black to a dirty gray, and was pocked with a dozen ragged-edged blaster burns.
"What?"
"That blaster fire was impressively accurate,"
Thrawn said, moving carefully toward the door.
"Fortunately, Chiss uniforms are designed to absorb and disperse as much energy as possible."
He looked down at his tunic.
"It is, unfortunately, not a perfect system."
"Still better than nothing," Anakin said,
his respect for the Chiss reluctantly rising a couple of notches. He'd seen hardened clone warriors turn to jelly with fewer wounds than that through their chest plates.
"You gonna be okay?"
"I've already treated the wounds,"
Thrawn said.
"Until they're fully healed, I'll make do. Are you ready?"
Stretching out to the Force, Anakin started the dead man doing a shuffle walk toward the door.
"Ready,"
he said. He moved up beside the puppet and put his left arm around the other's waist, supporting him as he might a wounded prisoner. He took a couple of experimental steps forward, moving the body's legs to keep time with his own.
"How does it look?"
"Adequate."
Walking stiffly to the door, Thrawn unlocked it.
Go. Good fortune.
Come on, R2,
Anakin said. The inside of the door, he saw now, was pocked with fresh blaster burns. Apparently, injured Chiss didn't shoot very accurately. Pushing open the door with his free hand, he stepped out into the street. Black Spire hadn't looked all that big as he and Thrawn rode through in their landspeeder. Not nearly big enough to support 400 or 500 people. But clearly it did. And every one of them seemed to have turned out to gawk at the Republic starfighter that had landed in the center of their town. Perhaps a dozen people turned as Anakin stepped into the sunlight. The rest of the crowd, still fascinated by the shiny fighter, ignored him completely.
Move aside,
Anakin called, pouring on every gram of authority that a lifetime's worth of war command had given him.
Move aside! Republic business!
He wasn't sure that people out here even knew what the Republic was, but if they didn't, the tone of his voice was apparently enough. The crowd began to shuffle aside, opening up a crooked path to the Actus.
Come on,
Anakin said under his breath, remembering to move the body's legs as he started down the open path, his senses alert to danger. If their quarry wanted to finish off either him or his injured comrade, or both, this would be the time for him to take that shot. No attacks had come by the time they reached the Actus. Anakin waited for R2-D2 to jet up and lock himself into his socket, then lifted his burden onto the top of the vehicle, pushing him as he would a wounded man, and making it look like the body's arms were searching weakly for handholds. He got him wedged between the droid and canopy rim. Then, remembering to keep the body's limbs moving in a hopefully realistic manner, he climbed into the cockpit and closed the canopy. Easing in the repulsor lifts, he rose into the sky. The Actus's jammers were designed to block enemy fighter transmissions hundreds of kilometers away. But that required a focused field, one that was primarily aimed forward toward where those enemies would normally be in battle. Still, the field spread out a short distance in all directions around the fighter, which meant he should be able to block anything from Black Spire up to around a dozen kilometers away. Rotating the Actus in midair, moving at a leisurely pace in order to give Thrawn as much time as he could, Anakin lined up the nose with Padme's distant ship. He eased in the thrusters. An instant later, there was a dull thud from beneath him, and the Actus suddenly rolled sideways, dropping nearly all the way onto its left side.
R2!
Anakin snapped as he jabbed the repulsor lift controls. Even as his brain registered the urgently glowing red lights on the monitor, the fighter leapt forward, pressing him back into his seat as the thrusters came on at full power, burning them through the air at maximum acceleration. A second later, the compensators kicked in, easing the pressure and letting him get to the controls again. Only there was nothing he could do. The thud he'd heard, he realized now, had been a small explosion from the Actus's portside repulsor lift. The only thing that had prevented the fighter from dropping onto that side and falling out of the sky was R2-D2's quick thinking in kicking in the thrusters. That had given them enough forward motion to create sufficient lift over the stubby airfoil wings to compensate for the lost repulsor lift. The only problem was that they were now blazing across Batuu at nearly 1,000 kilometers an hour, leaving Black Spire far behind. Lifting the jamming Thrawn was counting on to force their quarry out into the open. To make matters worse, somewhere in all of that flurry of activity, the body they decoyed their quarry with had slipped off the Actus and vanished into the forest far below. Cursing under his breath, Anakin grabbed the control yoke and sent the fighter into a tight 180-degree turn. Once he was pointed back at Black Spire, the communications blanket should come back into play. if their quarry had missed that brief window of opportunity, or if Thrawn had at least tagged him, they might still be able to pull this off. R2-D2 warbled a question.
I don't know, Anakin told him. The landing field, I guess. Unless he bought or rented a house here, he's probably living out of his ship. How much speed do we need to stay level without the repulsor lift?
The droid's answer wasn't encouraging.
No chance of going a little slower?
Anakin asked hopefully, cranking the thrusters back to just above R2-D2's estimated danger speed. The reply this time was more emphatic.
No, landing on our port side wing isn't really an option, Anakin said with a sigh. What about Thrawn's ship, the one in orbit? Did it have a port we could dock in?
Another whistled negative.
Yeah, I didn't see one either, Anakin said. Nothing to do but head back to Black Spire. Don't worry. I'll think of something.
By the time the outpost was once again in sight on the horizon, he had a plan. It wasn't much of a plan. Anakin himself didn't really like it. R2-D2 absolutely hated it. But Thrawn was down there, alone, injured, and facing a killer who might know where Padme was. If Anakin was going to be in time to help out, this was his only option. The landing field was a smaller clearing in the forest to the west of Black Spire. Anakin turned the Actis toward it, dropping to treetop level and keeping his speed as low as he could without losing control. The near end of the clearing flashed beneath him. He caught a glimpse of Thrawn, crouched behind his land speeder, exchanging blaster fire with a hooded figure that was moving toward him. Yanking back on the stick, he turned the Actis straight up, its nose pointed toward the sky, its thrusters blasting at the ground below. The sudden increase in air resistance against the fighter's belly pressed him into his seat and sent its forward momentum plummeting. He watched the airspeed indicator, mentally crossing his fingers. He was halfway across the landing field when he saw that the deceleration wasn't going to be enough. Long before the fighter came to a mid-air halt, it would be over the forest again, with no guarantee that there would be an open area where he could set it down. Which left him only one option. Punching the canopy control with one hand and his restraint release with the other, he stretched out to the force and jumped. His head barely cleared the still opening canopy, but the gamble worked. With the Actis rapidly slowing and the force adding speed and strength to his jump, Anakin found himself dropping almost straight down toward the clearing below. A quick twist of arms and hips to orient himself for a feet-first landing. He'd had barely enough time to grab his lightsaber when the hooded figure below raised his blaster and opened fire. Six bolts blazed through the air at him before he hit the ground amid a crunch and flurry of dead leaves. He bent his knees to absorb the impact, holding that crouching pose as his assailant continued to fire. Through the blaze of red blaster fire against blue lightsaber blade, he had a clear view of the face beneath the hood. Only it wasn't a living face. It was a metal one. A droid. His battle-focused brain had only just registered that fact when the droid abruptly twisted and toppled over as its right leg disintegrated beneath it. The blaster fired one final bolt at Anakin's torso, and the droid spasmed as Anakin sent the shot straight back into one of its photoreceptor eyes. Two more twitches, the death gaspings of a fatally damaged electronic brain, and the droid lay still. Slowly, Anakin straightened up, his eyes on the droid. He'd seen them fake shutdowns before. But no, this one was finished. He glanced around, noted that Thrawn had emerged from cover and was walking stiffly toward him. Lying next to one of the parked ships was another hooded figure. This one human, his arms locked behind him, making small movements of pain or frustration. One last 360-degree check of threats, and Anakin closed down his lightsaber.
Is that him?
He asked, nodding toward the twitching man.
It is, Thrawn said, coming to a stop beside him.
Interesting flight maneuver.
There's a lot of improvisation in warfare, Anakin said. He nudged the droid with his foot. What's his story?
I succeeded in arriving before our quarry, Thrawn said. As you anticipated, he was returning to his ship to report. Once it was clear which ship was his goal, I intercepted and neutralized him.
He gently touched a fresh burn on his chest.
I didn't expect such an adversary to be waiting inside.
Consider yourself lucky it was just a general service droid instead of a full-blown assassin, Anakin said grimly. They're a lot nastier.
If we find ourselves facing one of those in the future, I'll permit you to take the lead,
Thrawn promised. Anakin sent him a sideways look. Had that been actual humor?
It's a deal,
he agreed.
Let's go see what we've got.
The ship wasn't a style or model Anakin was familiar with, but it had a definite techno-union feel about it. The hatch was locked, but a few seconds of lightsaber work solved that problem. And once inside...
It's a separatist ship, all right, Anakin said, looking around. The equipment, the markings, even the controls. There's no doubt.
He hissed between his teeth.
The question is, what are they doing way out here?
The layout appears to be that of a freighter,
Thrawn pointed out.
Perhaps the cargo will give us a clue to their purpose.
In a minute,
Anakin said, pulling out his comlink.
R2, you there?
There was a disgusted-sounding grunt, followed by a long and unhappy account of his current situation.
I'm sure you did everything you could, Anakin soothed him. Do you need my help getting down?
There was another emphatic grunt.
Okay, then, Anakin said. We need you at the landing field. We're in the gray ship with... Look, just go to the down droid and turn left.
He keyed off.
Is your droid all right?
Thrawn asked.
He's fine, Anakin assured him. But my fighter is sitting about 5 meters off the ground, wedged vertically between 3 trees. Not sure I'm going to get it out without setting the forest on fire. Anyway, R2's fine, and he's on his way. Once he's here, we can check the computer and see if they still have the coordinates of their last stop.
We shall see, Thrawn said. While we wait, shall we look at the cargo?
Sure,
Anakin said, getting a fresh grip on his lightsaber.
There might be more droids lurking back there.
Follow me.
Chapter 5
I'm coming into Batuu now,
Padme said into her ship's recorder as the sunlit ground began to rise around her.
I'll signal you once I've found Ducha.
She hesitated. Should she add, I love you? Probably not. Aside from the chance that someone else might be around when Anakin listened to the message, this was going through an untested public relay service instead of the usual holonet. No telling what they might do before sending it on. Shutting down the recorder, she keyed for transmission. The display indicated that it had been received by the service and, hopefully, sent on its way. Whether it was or not, there was nothing more she could do about it. Time to find Ducha and see what her former handmaiden had learned that was so important. Hopefully, the information wouldn't already have been preempted by events. The trip here had taken longer than Padme had expected, with her nav computer's database proving sufficiently out of date to make its proposed courses unsafe.
She'd had to plot new segments twice, and at both times she'd wished she'd taken Anakin up on his offer to use Jedi resources to work out her travel arrangements.
But at least he'd be here much faster once she knew what was going on. Keying her comm to Ducha's frequency, she leaned toward the cockpit microphone.
Ducha, it's Padme,
she called.
I'm here.
no answer.
Duja?
She called again.
Duja, come in, please.
Nothing. Not even a carrier or transponder echo. She frowned, the first stirrings of concern starting to twist their way through her stomach. Duja was one of the best, both at intel and combat. If someone had managed to take her out... She took a deep breath. Okay, Duja wasn't answering. But that didn't necessarily mean something terrible had happened. Odds were she was simply away from her ship, with her comm turned off, for a perfectly good reason. The outpost Duja had specified, Black Spire, wasn't all that big. It shouldn't take more than an hour or two for Padme to have a look around. The landing field was small. Not all that surprising, given the size of the outpost itself. But there were only a pair of mid-sized freighters parked near the middle, leaving plenty of room for her to put down. She did so, picking a spot as far from the other ships as she reasonably could, and shut everything down to standby. Putting on a light green jacket with a subtle brown brocade running from left shoulder to right waist, the outside sensors said it was a bit nippy out there, and tucking her blaster out of sight beneath it, she cycled the hatch and stepped out. She had finished getting her Bark speeder bike out of the aft hull storage locker when she heard a voice call to her in an unknown language. She turned. A lumpy, non-human of a species she didn't recognize was crouching at the bottom of the nearest freighter's landing ramp.
Excuse me?
She called back.
He was complimenting you on your magnificent ship,
a human called from the top of the ramp.
Excuse us, but your basic is nor my language.
That's all right,
Padme called back, suppressing a knowing smile. Liar. He was trying hard. A little too hard, actually, to pretend he was struggling with a second language. But the basic words and syntax were coming just a little too easily and smoothly.
What are?
The man asked.
I mean, what species?
Species? Padme asked. Oh, you mean the model. It's an H-type Nubian yacht. Tell me, do you know someone named Kusef Jovi?
I know nothing of that name,
the man said.
Are you here to meet her?
A quiet warning bell went off in the back of Padme's mind. Why would he assume that the name she'd rattled off was that of a woman? Unless there was already an unknown woman in Black Spire who'd caught their attention.
To meet him,
she corrected.
I'm here to deliver his new ship.
Really?
The man said, eyeing the ship as he walked down the ramp. There was a lump at his side that probably indicated a hidden blaster.
Nice. What did he pay for it?
No idea,
Padme said.
I'm just a courier. Any idea who might know where I can find him? The ship that's picking me up could be here any time, and I want to finish the transaction so I can go home.
There's a cantina in the middle of town,
the man said, pointing down a ragged, edged corridor that had been cut through the trees and undergrowth toward the outpost itself.
If he's here, someone there will know him.
Thank you,
Padme said, climbing onto her speeder bike. She turned toward the corridor and headed in. She could feel the man's eyes on her as she left the field. She'd expected Black Spire to be like all the rest of the tiny frontier outposts she'd seen in her travels, carved out of the wilderness, with houses and shops laid out in a more or less orderly fashion along the major streets, though the term major was usually granting them more status than they deserved. And other buildings arranged haphazardly wherever their builders had felt like putting them. But this town had a twist. There were ruins here,
ancient ruins of some long-gone civilization bordering the colonists' town. A few of the buildings were completely or partially within shells of the older structures, while one or two others nestled against them as if for warmth or protection. Even more intriguing, the black tower she'd seen on her way in, obviously the source of the outpost's name, weren't structures or towers, but the petrified remains of trees, scattered like sentinels throughout the town and the region around it. The whole place struck her as beautiful, mysterious, and a little bit sad. But the populace, at least, conformed completely to Padme's expectations. Pedestrians and a few vehicles moved between the buildings, everyone pausing to give Padme a quick or furtive once-over as she passed. Genuine strangers were apparently rare here. Either that, or Duje had stirred up more attention than she'd probably wanted. At the intersection of the two main streets was the cantina the man had mentioned. There was a strange wooden platform off to one side, waist high, about 2 meters long, with some kind of yellowish straw-like decoration poking up around all the edges. Probably where the locals gathered for speeches, lectures, or just the general haranguing of their fellow citizens, she decided. There were two other vehicles parked at the other side of the entrance, and she guided her bark to a spot beside them. And as she walked toward the cantina door, she got her first real look at the platform. It wasn't a platform at all, but a box about 50 centimeters deep. The straw-like decoration was in fact actual straw, forming a mat at the box's bottom and lining the sides. Lying on the straw was a body. It wasn't a political dais like Padme had thought. It was instead an open-topped coffin, possibly being prepared for a funeral pyre. Duja's funeral pyre. Padme had trained long and hard to keep reactions and emotions out of her face and body when she needed to. But even all that practice nearly proved inadequate. She was barely able to maintain an expression of idle curiosity as she stepped over and peered into the coffin. Duje had been through the crusher, all right. Her face was battered and bruised in several places, and there were small stains on her clothing where blood had seeped through. The amateurishly handmade brooch she always wore seemed undamaged, and her chrono and data card pack were undisturbed. Not a robbery, then, but a cold-blooded attack. One thing was sure. If she'd fallen to violence, she hadn't gone down without a fight. That one quick glance was all she dared for the moment. But she would be back. Turning away, she pushed open the cantina door and went inside. Given that it wasn't yet local noon, she wasn't expecting much of a crowd. She was right. Apart from her and the bartender, there were only three others in the room. Two humans, and another of the lumpy aliens like the one at the landing field.
"You here for a drink?" the bartender called. "Or to pick up your friend?"
"My friend?"
Padme echoed, putting puzzlement into her face and voice. The bartender pointed through the wall toward the coffin.
"The lady out there."
No, not at all,"
Padme assured him.
"I'm looking for a man named Kusef Jovi. Do you know him?"
It was the bartender's turn to look puzzled.
"No one here by that name,"
he said.
"You sure you got the right place?"
"This is the spot where he said to bring his new ship,"
Padme said, walking over to the bar.
"I suppose he could be coming from off-planet, though why he'd pick a spot like this for the transfer, I couldn't guess. No offense,"
she added.
"None taken,"
the bartender assured her sourly.
"Not exactly Nucodia, is it?"
"Not really," Padme agreed,
wondering distantly whether New Codia was a system, a planet, or even just a city. There were so many small and forgotten places across the galaxy.
What do you have here?
What do you want? The bartender countered. We've got Batu Brew, Black Spire Brew, Blurg Fire, Tonnery White, and Dolan White, Mugen Tea, with or without Alto.
He rattled off another half a dozen drinks, none of which Padme had ever heard of. Local favorites, probably. She picked the Andoan White and watched as he selected a bottle and poured a few centimeters into a small obsidian mug.
So, what's her story?
She asked as the bartender set the mug down on the bar and accepted a 5-credit coin in exchange.
The lady in the box, I mean. What happened to her?
The bartender shrugged.
Don't really know. Some men from one of the trading ships brought her in a few days ago. Said they saw her try to take a corner too fast out in the forest and flipped her speeder bike on top of her. She was already dead when they got to her. So they brought her here, hoping someone in town knew who she was.
He shrugged again.
No one did. So he decided to give it a few days to see if anyone came looking for her. Not good to lose someone and never find out what happened.
No, it's not,
Padme said, taking a sip of her drink. The story was ridiculous. Ducha was one of the best speeder riders she'd ever seen. More likely she'd been poking around a suspicious ship, had been caught and tried to escape, and had either been hunted to ground or else forced into the accident they claimed had killed her, which would have left them with a huge problem. Ducha was smart enough not to carry any kind of genuine identification with her. As a result, her killers had no idea who she was, where she'd come from, or whether she had backup waiting for her. And they desperately needed answers to those questions. So after pawing through her data cards without finding anything useful, they'd cleaned her up as best they could, brought her to Black Spire, and talked the residents into setting her outside the cantina in the hope of drawing out her contacts. The big question for Padme was whether they'd tracked down Duja's ship and sifted it for its own set of data and secrets. If they had, her investigation was effectively over. If they hadn't found it, if Ducha had hidden it somewhere out of their reach, there was still a chance of taking them down. And the more Padme thought about it, the more the latter scenario seemed the most likely. If the killers had already gotten everything they wanted, they probably wouldn't have bothered to dangle Ducha as bait.
Who's the Undoan?
The bartender asked, the mystery of the dead woman outside apparently already forgotten.
Good,
Padme told him. It actually wasn't bad. Certainly not for a local brand.
Do you think anyone would mind if I wrote a song for her?
Wrote a... what?
He asked, frowning.
If I wrote a farewell song,
Padme said.
It's the custom of my people to sing to the departed on their journey, with songs of encouragement and hope.
I thought you said you didn't know her.
I don't, Padme said. But it sounds like no one else here does either. And truly, it's the lost strangers who lack encouragement and hope the most.
The bartender waved a hand.
I suppose. Fine, go ahead. I can't imagine it bothering anyone.
Padme took her time with the job, aware that she was running close numbers, but also knowing that making it look rushed and anxious might attract the wrong kind of attention. Half an hour, and a second Andoan White later, she was ready. The bartender kept surreptitious watch on her the whole time, either because he'd been instructed to do so, or just out of bored curiosity. As she finished her drink and picked up her data pad, he came back to her end of the bar.
So what happens now?
He asked.
You want me to gather some folks to come watch?
You can come if you want to,
Padme said. Not that she wanted an audience, but it would look suspicious if she refused the offer.
But it's not necessary. I'll be singing privately to her. So there won't be anything for anyone to hear.
The bartender grunted.
Yeah, okay. Gotta get ready for the lunch crowd anyway. Have fun.
There were a few more people in the streets when she emerged from the bar. All of them going about their own business. Most of them barely giving her a cursory glance before continuing on. She moved to the head of the casket, held her data pad over Duja's body, and began to sing. She'd had to write the song as if to a stranger. But beneath the vague words and simple tune, she could feel her heart breaking at the loss of her friend and one-time bodyguard. Memories came flooding back of the interweaving of their lives, both the good times and the bad. The hopes and dreams and fears they'd shared that were now gone forever. There was the time when Duja helped her decipher an unintelligible communication from an angry ambassador, a potential diplomatic crisis that had been diffused when Duja suddenly realized the ambassador simply hadn't liked the way Padme pronounced the name of a fellow envoy. There were the late-night conversations after everyone else had gone to bed, when the two of them talked about the future and all that they hoped those days would bring. There was the aftermath of the attempted assassination on Coruscant that had taken Corday's life, and the private tears Padme and Duja had shared together. Now Duja was gone, and Padme would have to leave her here, and would likely never be able to give her a proper funeral. Duja would understand, and under the circumstances would certainly not want Padme to risk her own life and safety merely for respect and decorum. But that didn't make it any easier. She finished her song, and for a moment gazed down at her friend. Then, keeping her expression that of a compassionate stranger, merely doing her ethical duty, she pulled out the data card on which she'd written the song and laid it on Duja's chest. And when she brought her hand up out of the coffin, she had Duja's brooch pressed invisibly into her palm. Giving Duja one final look, she turned away and headed back to her bark. The man and the alien were still loitering by their freighter when she reached her ship.
Any luck?
The man called.
No,
Padme called back as she stowed the bark into its hold.
I guess I'll try some of the other outposts. Maybe he just messed up the name and coordinates.
Yeah, good luck,
the man said.
If you can't find him, come on back. I'll take it off your hands for a good price.
You wish,
Padme said, forcing a casual cheerfulness she didn't feel. With a friendly wave, she walked up the ramp, sealed the hatch, and headed back across the sky. But not very far. Certainly not all the way to the next outpost. This was where Duja had planned to meet. And here, somewhere, was where she'd hidden her ship. Only now, Padme had the way to find it. She'd traveled about 30 kilometers when she spotted a promising-looking clearing. She set her ship down at one edge and walked outside. Blaster ready, while she checked the perimeter for large animals or other threats. Satisfied that nothing was preparing to pounce, she tucked the blaster away and pulled out Duja's brooch. Duja had taken a fair amount of ribbing over the years by people who couldn't understand why a woman who otherwise knew all the ways of fashion and elegance would wear something that outlandish in public. It was made of moldable plastoid, fashioned with the exuberance and total lack of skill of a 5-year-old child. But then that was exactly the look Duja had been going for when she made it. A child's loving creation, worn as a tribute by a proud and doting mother. Padme smiled sadly at the thought. Duja had talked about one day settling down and having a child who might make such an earnest gift for real. Now, That would never happen. Maybe one day, if the war ever ended, Padme might find that kind of peaceful life for herself. If so, she would dedicate the first of her firstborn's creations to Duja's memory. But that was the future. This was the present. Wiping away a sudden tear with the back of her hand, Padme raised the brooch, the one piece of jewelry no thief would ever bother with, and squeezed it hard in the center. Whether through luck or simply their long association enabling the two women to anticipate each other's moves, Padme had landed almost on top of Duja's hiding place. Barely 2 minutes after triggering the beck and call, buried deep within the brooch, Duja's ship suddenly appeared overhead, floating down on its repulsor lifts to a sheltered spot at the other edge of the clearing. It settled to a stop, and the hatch popped open. Taking a deep breath, feeling a fresh sense of loss, Padme stepped inside. Duja's ship was small and plain, the kind of ship flown by billions of ordinary people across the galaxy. As in so many cases, though, appearances were deceiving. Padme walked past the twin bunks and the compact galley, squeezed through the cockpit doorway, and slipped into the pilot's seat.
"This is Queen Padme Amidala of Naboo," she announced.
She hadn't been queen for years, of course, which made it unlikely that anyone else would think to use that title as an identification phrase.
"Duja, talk to me."
There was a short pause. Then, like a ghost from a lost past, Duja's voice came through the speaker.
"Hello, my lady,"
she said. There was none of her usual impish humor, but only a hard-edged focus.
"I've been poking around this area, and I believe I've uncovered a separatist factory on Mokinja."
Padme blinked. A factory? Way out here?
"I don't know what they're making or who's in charge, but from what I've been able to glean, it's a top-notch operation. I've got the location. Planetary coordinates are in the attached file, and I'll see what I can learn about its layout and defenses before you get here."
Padme sighed. That search was probably what had led to her death.
"Of course, I'll wait until you get here, before we make our move against it. Depending on what we find, we might even be able to get the Chancellor or the Jedi to come out and join us."
"Guaranteed," Padme murmured the promise to her friend. Because the minute Anakin heard about Duja's death, he would be here in a Coruscant second, whether or not the Council had him slated for some other duty.
"Travel safely, my lady, and we'll see you soon."
The recorder clicked off. For a few minutes, Padme sat silently in the command seat, gazing out at the forest, and offering one final farewell to her friend. Then, slowly, she reached to the control board and pulled up the factory's coordinates. Duja had planned to wait for Padme before moving against the facility. That hadn't ended well. The smart move for Padme now would be to send an alert to Anakin and wait until he arrived before taking any further action. Only the Separatists were onto them now. They'd caught Duja, and the presence of the coffin outside the cantina proved they suspected she had backup on the way. Worse, they'd now seen Padme and were undoubtedly putting two and two together. If she hung around Batu too long, waiting for Anakin, there was a good chance they'd run her down. Even if she avoided that fate, if she took her ship into deep space, say, and hid there, what would happen to the factory in the meantime? She'd seen Separatists destroy factories and mining facilities rather than let Republic forces get them. And if this place was as secret as its location implied, it was all the more likely that she and Anakin would arrive to find nothing but smoking debris. No. Duja had given her life to alert the Republic to this threat. Padme wasn't going to waste that sacrifice by sitting around doing nothing until Anakin could get free. where the Separatists could cover their tracks. Which wasn't to say she thought she could attack the factory all by herself. Years of terrible risks and narrow escapes had proved that she was anything but indestructible. On the other hand, the enhanced shields and heavy weaponry lurking beneath the plain exterior of Duja's ship gave Padme an advantage that the Separatists would never expect. Surely, she could at least take a quick look and try to figure out what they were doing there. Reaching to the control board again, she keyed for a quick pre-flight diagnostic. She would collect a few supplies from her own ship and send a final message to Anakin, and she'd be ready to go. A quick trip to Mokivja, a brief look around, and she'd be back. Probably before Anakin even arrived. She smiled to herself as she squeezed back out of the cockpit. It was rare when she was able to surprise Anakin, but it was always so satisfying when she did. There were two more droids waiting in the rear of the freighter, but Anakin was ready, and it was easy to sucker them at the choke points where he had the advantage. Two skirmishes later, he and Thrawn arrived at the cargo bay. Unfortunately, there wasn't much information to be gleaned once they got there.
If the labels are correct, these appear to contain various alcoholic beverages,
Thrawn commented, as they walked slowly between the lines of safety-webbed crates.
Does that seem odd for your Separatists?
Not really, Anakin said. Separatists drink as much as everyone else.
He picked a crate of Tevraki whiskey, popped off the webbing, and used the Force to lift it from its shelf and lower it to the deck.
Twister sealed,
Thrawn murmured, peering at the fasteners.
There should be an opening tool somewhere nearby.
Never mind,
Anakin said, igniting his lightsaber. He carefully sliced off the top of the crate. It wasn't a line of bottles that glittered at him in the dim light. Instead, an orderly row of slender metal ingots filled the crate, separated by soft plastoid spacers.
Interesting, Thrawn said. It appears to be gold.
You're right,
Anakin said, running a finger over one of the ingots.
Is that metal valuable on your worlds?
It is on some of them,
Anakin said.
But mostly it's used in manufacturing. Pieces this thin would probably be used in extruding machines for making wire or parts of high-performance circuit modules.
Machines of that sort will have many uses.
True,
Anakin said. If this was a techno-union ship, gold ingots implied droid manufacturing. But Thrawn was right. Wires and circuit modules were used in everything from household cookers to major warships. The fact that the Separatists were moving metals didn't tell them anything.
Still, knowing the ship's destination is a manufacturing facility tells us a great deal,
Thrawn said.
It indicates that Batuu is not simply a waypoint for finished products, nor is it being used as a transfer point for data or personnel.
I suppose, Anakin said.
Fine. So it told them more than he'd thought.
I guess that's it.
There may yet be more.
And you're welcome to poke around as much as you want, Anakin growled. I'm going back to the command deck and see if R2's found anything.
He turned and headed for the cargo bay hatch.
A moment,
Thrawn said. Anakin turned back, pushing back a flush of irritation. He just said there wasn't anything more to learn back here.
What?
Thrawn was standing in front of one of the other crates.
Do you recognize this one?
He asked, pointing to it.
Of course I recognize it,
Anakin said with strained patience.
I recognize all of them. They're the crates in here that we've just seen.
Indeed,
Thrawn said.
The interesting part is that we've seen this one twice.
What are you talking about?
A crate with these same markings was aboard one of the smugglers' land vehicles. Similar markings on similar packages isn't that unusual.
Not similar,
Thrawn interrupted.
Identical.
Slowly frowning at the crate, Anakin walked back to him.
Are you sure?
Very sure,
Thrawn assured him.
Perhaps we should see what's inside. Perhaps we should.
Again, Anakin used the Force to lower it to the deck, then sliced off the top with his lightsaber.
Whoa,
he said, feeling his eyes widen as he caught sight of the thin plates inside.
You recognize them?
Thrawn asked.
I recognize the metal,
Anakin said.
It's quadranium. Very hard, very dense, very valuable. It's used for hull plates, heavy armor, and anything else you really want to stand up to blasters and laser cannons.
Interesting,
Thrawn murmured.
I wonder how the smugglers came to own an identical crate.
Yeah,
Anakin said darkly. This one, at least, was obvious.
Let's find out.
Igniting his lightsaber again, he sliced off the front of the crate. Just as he'd suspected. The top two layers were quadranium plates. Below that, the box was filled with scrap metal.
There you go,
he said, gesturing to the scrap.
Seems our smugglers are also thieves.
Thrawn gazed at the crate for a long moment.
Indeed,
he said.
So we're dealing with two groups of opponents, not one. That explains a great deal.
Really?
Anakin asked, frowning.
What specifically does it explain?
In a moment, Thrawn said.
First, I believe you wish to see if your droid had identified this ship's destination or origin.
Okay,
Anakin said. There was clearly something here that Chiss wasn't saying. But the ship's history, and hopefully Padme's location, was his first priority.
Sure, come on.
R2-D2 had indeed found something.
Huh,
Anakin said, frowning at the display.
Sir Mao. Never heard of it.
Bear in mind that knowledge of this ship's destination does not necessarily mean your ambassador traveled there,
Thrawn reminded him.
Oh, she's there, all right,
Anakin said with a grimace.
She and Duja both, probably.
That seems foolhardy for an ambassador.
It's foolhardy for anyone,
Anakin said.
But that's Padme.
She never bothers with the odds when there's something that needs to be done.
Thrawn was silent a moment.
She sounds like a remarkable person, he said. I look forward to meeting her. Still, there's more we need to know before we travel there.
Fine. You stay here and study the situation,
Anakin said.
That's my ambassador out there. I'm going.
A moment,
Thrawn said. Glowering, Anakin turned back.
What now?
Thrawn was staring at the display where R2-D2 had put up Ser Mao's planetary data.
You say this information was stored in the ship's navigational computer.
Yes, of course.
Easily accessible to anyone who searched for it.
Well, not easily,
Anakin said.
R2 had to dig.
Does it seem reasonable that the Separatists would handle such critical data this way?
They weren't expecting anyone except themselves to be in here,
Anakin reminded him patiently.
Your ambassador was also not expecting intruders,
Thrawn reminded him.
Yet her messages were nevertheless encrypted.
Anakin felt his stomach tighten. That was a good point, actually.
So, what are you saying?
He asked slowly.
That this is just a cover for the real data?
Perhaps, Thrawn said. Ask your droid if there were any other navigational files in the computer.
R2-D2 warbled a negative.
He said no,
Anakin translated.
Then the data is accurate, Thrawn concluded. But the presumed destination may not be.
What do you...
Oh,
Anakin said, nodding as he understood.
The course points to Ser Mao, but their actual landing site may be somewhere else.
Exactly, Thrawn said. How many inhabitable systems are along that route?
Let's find out, Anakin said. R2, pull up a list of systems. Give me everything we've got on them.
Minutes later, the droid had the results. They weren't promising.
11 of them?
Anakin growled, running his eye over R2-D2's list.
And you've got nothing on any of them except Batu?
R2-D2 grunted with some mechanical frustration of his own.
It's not hopeless, Thrawn soothed. You see that the Separatists have provided data files of their own.
What, these?
Anakin demanded, jabbing a finger toward the display.
You've got to be joking. Batu? Home to ancient ruins and giant petrified black trees? Uma? Galaxy-class hunting? Yokorki? Wide selection of edible wild fungi? Mokivja? 10 moons, beautiful sunsets. Plude? Majestic seascapes? It's like they pulled these out of travel brochures.
Then we'll need to narrow down the list,
Thrawn said.
Starting with your captive outside?
I doubt he knows anything useful, Thrawn said. He claims to be merely an engine mechanic.
And you believe him?
The scars and burn marks on his hands tend to support his claim, Thrawn said. Regardless, I need a larger group for the interrogation I have in mind. Perhaps the drama currently playing out near the cantina will suit our needs.
Anakin frowned.
What drama?
5 beings entered the cantina after our departure and carried the bartender away, Thrawn said. They appear to be awaiting his return to consciousness. From their conversation, I deduce they're associated with both the group we encountered in the forest and the 4 beings who assaulted us in the cantina.
So they did call back to Black Spire to have someone deal with us,
Anakin said, nodding.
It is not quite so simple, Thrawn warned. You forget they targeted you for death. The 5 now with the bartender are concerned about the owners of this ship and fear their thefts have been discovered. They're also unclear whether you and I are associated with the ship owners, your ambassador, or neither.
You're right. It sounds like we need to have a chat with them,
Anakin said.
Indeed,
Thrawn advised.
Again, it's not quite so simple. The human I followed to this vehicle was not alone.
He had a friend?
4 friends,
Thrawn corrected.
I believe that even now, they're listening unannounced to the smuggler's conversation, as they also await the bartender's return to consciousness.
Anakin looked out the viewport. A ship this size, a cargo bay this size, the one who'd come back, plus the 4 Thrawn said were waiting for the bartender to wake up. Yes, that could very well be the entire ship's complement. And having all the Separatists gathered together in one spot could be very handy.
How do you know all this?
After the battle, while you were still unconscious, I took the precaution of putting a listening device on the bartender's clothing,
Thrawn said.
I've been following their conversations ever since.
Anakin felt a tight smile tug at his lips.
And since the bartender isn't awake yet, everyone's just sitting around waiting and worrying out loud. And since our jamming's still going, none of them can talk to anyone else.
He broke off, frowning.
Wait a minute. How are you getting messages from the bartender if we're jamming all communications?
My listening device does not utilize normal communication methods,
Thrawn said.
It translates speech into powerful sonic signals at frequencies far above those detectable by any known species. The signals are received by another device, which I placed on a wall near the cantina, which further translates the sound into a pattern of invisible flickering lights. The lights are reflected from nearby objects. Here, the stone trees, and collected by a device on my vehicle. They're then translated back into high-frequency sound, which is again converted to speech by my earpiece. Anakin whistled under his breath.
That's quite a system. A lot of work, though, isn't it?
It is, Thrawn said. Yet I have communication, and they do not.
Can't argue with that, Anakin agreed. Okay, R2, stay here and see what else you can find out. Commander Thrawn and I have a party to go to.
Chapter 6. The residents who had gathered earlier to gawk at Anakin's starfighter had long since moved on, some of them gathering around street carts for quick food or drink, others haggling with the owners of the various shops, still others moving furtively on darker errands. A few of the patrons seated at the cantina's handful of outdoor tables were watching Anakin and Thrawn as they approached, but none seemed inclined to comment or question, let alone interfere.
"Where are they?"
Anakin murmured, as they parked their landspeeder across the winding street. The cantina's window shutters, he noted, were still closed.
"Inside?"
"A moment." Thrawn reached to the landspeeder's displays and made a small adjustment.
"They're indoors, approximately 50 meters away." "I'm guessing over there,"
Anakin said, eyeing a doorway that led into one of the many dingy shops. 5 hard-looking men were loitering near the door, eating small-hand meals that looked like they'd come from a street vendor. So much for Thrawn's fancy surveillance equipment. Sometimes all it took was someone with eyes and a brain to figure these things out.
"Very possibly," Thrawn said. "I assume the one eating with his dominant hand is the leader."
Anakin frowned. Dominant hand? What was Thrawn talking about? Then he got it. All 5 had blasters on their right hips, but only one was holding his meal in his right hand. The others were instead eating with their left hands, leaving their gun hands free. The underlings needed to be ready to fire at a moment's notice, while the boss could be a little more leisurely about it. It seemed like a leap to Anakin, but possibly Thrawn was seeing something else that he wasn't. Certainly the right-hander didn't seem any less thug-like than the others. With droids making up the main Separatist forces, and with none of the droids he'd seen moving around Black Spire less than 30 years old, whoever was running the secret base had probably had to hire local talent for his muscle.
"The boss and the hired help," he commented.
"Perhaps," Thrawn said.
He reached into the speeder's side storage pocket and pulled out a small set of powered optics. He lifted them to his eyes, paused a moment, then nodded.
"However, their clothing all follows the same pattern, and not the pattern of those who attacked us in the cantina. If they're hired help, they share the same origin as their commander."
He held up a finger.
"The bartender has regained consciousness. Let us observe the actions of the humans in the street."
The wait wasn't long. Barely 10 seconds after Thrawn's announcement, the 5 men were on the move, tossing their food away and settling their hands onto their blasters. One of them glanced both ways down the street and stiffened as he caught sight of Anakin and Thrawn.
"We've been spotted,"
Anakin growled, drawing his lightsaber, but keeping it below the level of the windscreen where it was out of the thug's view. All 5 were now looking surreptitiously at them.
"You have a plan?"
He nodded his head sideways at Thrawn's damaged tunic.
"You're not exactly in top form for a fight."
Indeed, I'm not, Thrawn conceded. Are you familiar with a beast known as Erik?
Anakin snorted. The Petronaki Arena back on Geonosis, and the horned monster that had tried to eviscerate him, Padme, and Obi-Wan.
Quite familiar,
he assured the Chiss dryly.
Prepare to emulate one.
Prepare to emulate one? Anakin opened his mouth to ask what in the world Thrawn meant by that, and suddenly, the landspeeder leapt forward, accelerating down the winding street directly toward the five thugs. They'd traveled maybe a third of the distance, and the thugs had all drawn their blasters when he finally got it. Standing up, he got a grip on the windscreen and jumped over it to land on the vehicle's hood. He slid all the way forward and slipped the fingers of his left hand into an air intake vent to keep from falling off. And with the landspeeder now indeed looking like a Jedi-horned reek, he ignited his lightsaber. The thugs had just enough time for their eyes to widen in stunned disbelief and scramble for cover before the landspeeder blew into their midst. The two closest went flying as the vehicle rammed into them, throwing them 5 meters backward. The next two had made it just far enough to the sides to avoid getting run down.
Double vision. Blaster rising, close at hand, preparing to fire.
The first of the two, the one Thrawn had identified as the leader, jerked back as Anakin's close-in lightsaber slash sliced his blaster in half.
Double vision. The thug behind him ducking and shooting from waist-high position.
The second managed one shot. Anakin's blade was already in position to deflect it into the wall beside him.
Double vision. Thrawn breaking hard and spinning the rear of the landspeeder around toward the last thug. The thug jumping back out of the way. The thug drawing a thermal detonator from his waistband.
Anakin leapt straight up just as Thrawn began the maneuver, turning in midair as the man dodged to the side and reached for the detonator. His hand began to emerge, his lips curling into a snarl, which became a gasp as Anakin hurled his lightsaber, sending the blade spinning through the detonator and half of the man's hand. The thug fell to the ground and lay crumpled against the ancient wall, his face screwed up in pain as he gripped the remains of his hand. The landspeeder had braked nearly to a halt by the time Anakin landed on the hood again. He used the force to recall his lightsaber to his hand, then dropped into a crouch to catch his balance and spun back to the thug who'd taken that single shot at him.
Double vision. Shots coming at torso and head.
He blocked both, sending the second shot into the thug's own chest and dropping him to the street beside his comrade. Even as he collapsed, Thrawn was climbing stiffly out of the landspeeder and hurrying to the two he'd rammed earlier.
Well? Anakin called, giving each of the other thugs a quick look.
Both are injured and unconscious, Thrawn said. Have we one who can still speak?
I think so,
Anakin said, turning his eyes and his lightsaber toward the leader. The thug was staring back, the grip half of his bisected blaster still clenched in his hand.
Not really sure.
Indeed,
Thrawn said. He crossed to Anakin's thug, drawing his blaster as he walked.
You're not a warrior.
Belatedly, the man's eyes shifted to the Chiss. Your name? Thrawn prompted. The man swallowed visibly.
Oenti! He said. I'm an inspector. Just an inspector. A cargo inspector.
Haven't done a very good job of it, have you?
Anakin suggested mildly.
Let's take this talk inside, shall we?
Yes, let's,
Thrawn agreed.
These are your people, General. You'd best lead the way.
No problem,
Anakin said. He got a grip on Oenti's arm and pulled him over to the door his group had been focused on. A double lightsaber slash through the cheap lock and equally cheap hinges, a flick of his hand to send the door flying inward with a crash, and he gave the thug a more insistent shove inside. The room they were in was a shop of some sort, with shelves and bins loaded with exotic curios, poorly made counterfeits of Core World art projects, and a lot of unidentifiable bits of flotsam and jetsam. A faded damask curtain hung over a doorway beside the counter, and as Anakin pushed his prisoner toward it, two long-snouted beings flung it aside and charged out into the front room, and came to a sudden halt as they spotted the intruders already halfway to them. One of them raised his blaster.
"Don't!"
Anakin said, lifting his lightsaber a little higher over Oenti's shoulder. The would-be attacker hesitated, focused briefly on Oenti, then looked back at Anakin.
"Who are you?"
"We are not your friends,"
Thrawn said, moving out from behind Anakin and taking a couple of steps to the side.
"But we are not necessarily your enemies. We seek information and believe you can supply it."
"Or we can kill all of you and get what we want from this one," Anakin offered, tugging on the shoulder of Oenti's shirt with his free hand. "Your choice."
One of the long snouts swallowed, a long rippling motion of the throat, and lowered his weapon.
"Yes,"
he said, stepping aside and gesturing toward the curtain.
"Come inside. We shall talk."
"Yes, we shall," Anakin said. "You can just leave the weapons here."
The two long snouts looked at each other. Then, wordlessly, they set their blasters on the counter, pushed back the curtain, and disappeared through the doorway. Anakin and Oenti were right behind them. The room looked to be a stockroom of sorts, with crates and shelves and more bins scattered randomly around. The bartender was lying on a dilapidated couch, his head propped up, still looking bleary-eyed from the aftermath of the gas attack. Two humans and another long snout were seated on stools clustered around him, all three of them now twisted around at the waist as they stared at the newcomers.
"Oenti?"
one of them demanded cautiously, as the first two long snouts silently walked around behind the rest of the group and took up positions there.
"Hello, Jannot,"
Anakin's prisoner said, a dark note in his voice.
"Don't bother to get up. So, Jannot the friendly bartender. This explains a lot."
"I don't know what you're talking about,"
the bartender protested, but his eyes were suddenly awake and alert.
"No, I think you do,"
Oenti said, looking around at the rest of the group.
"Your friends are on the Duke's list, you know. The whole gang is. You realize I'd have been shot if he figured out what you were doing?"